Welcome to B&B Financially Free, the podcast for ambitious individuals chasing financial freedom through buying short-term rental investments. We're your hosts, Chantel and Peter, and we're the founders of Good Neighbor Realty. Our brokerage has helped hundreds of people turn their active income into passive income by buying unique properties in incredible locations that are earning a ton of money. On this show, we'll bring on a diverse range of guests, from industry experts to everyday people who have achieved extraordinary results in their short-term rental investments, businesses, and personal lives. Whether you're seeking tactical advice or trying to unlock your richest life, B&B Financially Free is here to join you on the journey. I could not be more excited to have Mr. James in the house this afternoon. How are you, Kyle?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on today just because, I mean, I think both of us feel like this, but we're just buds, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And we were just talking about when we met. So It's been 2021, but I feel like the cool thing is we've really gotten to see each other grow over the past couple of years. You've gotten to see us like grow the brokerage, and I've gotten to see you grow from like a small real estate portfolio to this big bag management company. And I'm just really excited to get into all of that.
Well, I am very excited as well.
Awesome. So for those of you who don't know Kyle, so Kyle not only owns one of the best property management companies in Colorado, it's growing rapidly because of all of the tools that you guys have to increase people's revenue. And I love that about your management company. But not only that, is you have bought extraordinary properties for your personal portfolio. And I just want to start by digging into like your story on how you started from a short-term rental perspective and like talk to us about the properties that you have personally under your portfolio.
Yeah, I'd love to. So in 2019 or 2020, early 2020, I started, like many people, listening to podcasts, listening to Bigger Pockets, starting to understand that people buy homes not just to live in. Truly, at that point, I didn't understand that people bought homes for any other reason. And then a friend of mine's dad had actually been doing a lot of real estate investing and development and kind of took me under his wing. And I started hanging out with him more than I hung out with my friend and learning about it. And then that's actually when I clicked on an ad for Good Neighbor Realty's event they were having at Peter's house. So when I first met Chantal and Peter, it was just the two of you. I think maybe you had hired one employee in Garrett Newell at the time. And so we went to Peter's ADU behind his house. He told us how much money he was making. At that point, I think this is in 2021, I'd understood enough to know that I wanted to kind of go down this rabbit hole, but I still had a W-2 job. I still didn't exactly understand what a good investment was, but you know, we were learning rapidly. So in that event, I actually ended up meeting Chantal, and we started working pretty closely together from there, looking at homes. And I think you took me on probably, I don't know, 40, 50 showings.
We did.
Yeah, quite a few. And I would walk into a house and just say no right off the bat. I think that we'll get into this a little bit, but some of the things that makes those two properties do so well, and you know this as well as anyone, isn't just what it says on Zillow. It's also kind of the feeling it gave us when we would walk into the property, how we felt like guests would take it, the vision we saw when we'd walk in on what we could create from that. I think you said the other day that the best properties are made, not bought. And so that's something that I've definitely taken to heart. And you had been so gracious to show me all the different properties that are in kind of your portfolio and in your customers, if they would let you, and the numbers that they did. And so although I was saying no very quickly, I was underwriting every one of those properties 20, 30 times and seeing the better, best, worst scenario. And then in May of 2021, we bought the first property. That property sits off of a pretty busy road, a road federal highway in Colorado, which isn't really known for being the nicest road in the world.
It's not right on federal.
It is within 0.1 of a mile.
I would not let you buy a property straight on federal. It was off of federal.
It is
off
of federal.
We're talking about Westminster, right?
It is in Westminster, yes.
Okay, no, your property is not right on federal. It's really close to federal highway. Here's an expert realtor tip. Don't buy a property on like a super busy street unless you understand that the value is going to be about 20% less from a resale perspective, your property is near a like high traffic area. It's not the most like pristine location. It's not the worst location either. But yeah, anyways, sorry.
Well, no, I think that, I mean, it was the probably the maybe the best thing I've done in the last 5 years was buy that house. So it's not to take away from it in any point. But when I got, I guess when I was driving up to it, I wasn't expecting to buy it that day.
Really? I don't think we've talked about this.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I don't think I went to any home expecting to buy it on the first day either, though. But when we walked in there, I mean, it was beautiful. It was 2,700 square feet. The yard was a mess, which I loved because it was just all mud. The old owner used to keep RVs there. But I just saw that as kind of a playground to build on and to create something special. And at the time, I think themes and themed properties were just starting. And if, I don't know if anyone really did it, to the extent they're doing it today by any means. So we had that vision together and kind of talked about that and was very confident, this is the right house. But even after that, we'd get setting it up. And I think the day before I listed, I remember distinctly that I was scared to list it because we had just spent pretty much my life savings on this property. I wasn't didn't understand anything from a creative finance standpoint, didn't understand investors. I just knew I needed to bring the money and get it done and that the ROI looked good on paper. So we ended up purchasing that property. That property we bought for $525,000, the 3.25% interest rate. Looking back on it, I'd have bought it again just for that. And then ended up putting in about $110,000. In year one, that property did about $136,000 with about $65,000 in cash flow. And at the time, I was making, I think, $63,000 in my W-2 job. So that was a pretty big change.
I remember that. Like, and it's so cool to think about how, because it was the same for me, right? Like one property can really be like a life-changing asset and can kind of give you that base salary that would be nice to have if you're going to start like a career as an entrepreneur. And you're right, when you were talking about how, you know, at that time, people weren't really doing themes. Like, you were the first person that I sold a home to that went for it from a theme perspective. And I was really nervous, honestly, because it was, you were like, I'm going to make this really funky. I'm going to add the volleyball court. You did it like a groovy theme with like purple couches and disco balls. And like, that's very normal in our space now. And now everybody is looking to do that. But at that time, nobody was really talking about it. And so when you sent it to me, and you've described yourself as an experienced curator, which is exactly what you are. That is, I think, one of your strongest gifts. But when you first sent it to me, I was like, oh God, I hope that this does well. And then boom, like it did so well. And the coolest thing that, and I use this as an example all the time, is I had sold similar houses in the exact same neighborhood with the exact same bedroom count that looked very similar to that property that you purchased, but those properties were earning $90,000 annually and you were earning $130,000 annually. So what do you think, because now that you have seen this from a lot of fronts, you've seen this from your personal portfolio, you've seen it from other people's portfolio, why can you buy the same type of property, but one perform much higher than the other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. That's a loaded question because it's such a, it starts with the buy, absolutely. I mean, with that house was 500 square foot more than the other homes in the area. Not only that, but the layout set up correctly. And what I mean by correctly is they had big open living areas. They had bedrooms that could take king beds. And so it's not just about the theme. I mean, it starts with the buy. We felt like there's a couple things that home had, big gathering areas, the outdoor space, which we ended up turning into a volleyball court, made a big difference. But I guess, you know, why is it different from those other properties? It's all of those little things that add up. So you start with the right property, and then you start with, I think, kind of the actual amenities that you're going to put in the house, right? Before you even get to a theme, what are we going to do with this yard? What are we going to do with this basement? What are we going to do with these different, you know, areas that are kind of where they come to? And in that house, we decided to do a massive game room. We decided to do that volleyball court and then a turf area, a hot tub, a fire pit area, which all seem like normal things now, but no one in the area had been doing them then. And then from there, you can't just have the amenities. You got to kind of make it stick out on the OTAs. At the time, we weren't doing a direct booking website. How do we get our property to stick out among all the other properties in the area? And, you know, I think now we've changed our perspective a little, but at the time it was how much color can we put in this house, right? Mm-hmm. And how many ways can we get it to stick out? So we did like 5 or 6 murals. We're doing some smaller things too. I think we did, me and a contractor sat there and did 20 disco balls in a chandelier with fishing wire and made that kind of stand out. And, you know, we really thought we were doing something at the time.
And you were. I mean, it was iconic. Like, you were the first person. Like, I literally at that time did not have another person on my radar that had done something like that. Where did you get the inspiration to take a swing like that? Like, had you seen someone else at that time be successful with going kind of funky and non-traditional? Because I think at that time, a lot of people were buying nice homes and they were furnishing them like you would furnish a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And you at that time understood that these are not hotels.
Mm-hmm.
These are something different. People are looking for something different in this type of asset. So what led you to that? Was it intuitive or did you see it modeled?
There was definitely some comps on AirDNA and on when we were looking at in some areas in town that were doing far better than the other homes. And then our thought was, how do we take it one more step? And also, you know, these are tertiary markets around Denver. They're not downtown. So why is somebody, you know, what's going to drag them out of downtown and bring them together as a family? Our market for that property is not luxury. It is not, it's also not, you know, super budget, but it's your middle of the road families that maybe are coming together to meet in Denver. They have, maybe they have a soccer tournament or they want to get together as family just to get together. Or maybe we've had everything down to like, we don't really get much corporate at that property, but we have had groups of corporate come as well.
And families too, you know, sometimes families like are we'll gear it and we'll think, oh, this would be so great for a bachelor party or a bachelorette. And then parents are like, oh, this is so great for my kids. They're going to have like plenty to do. They're going to entertain themselves. And then like multiple families being able to gather is also a really big thing.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I was watching all the podcasts, they were saying be different and we were looking at some of the comps and we just kind of went for it. At that point, we were, you know, didn't exactly know what we were doing. Got lucky as much as we were smart.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And then something that you said is like your properties are not, well, one of them is, but this property was like not a luxury property. I think I previously had the misconception that like if you purchased a luxury property that you would make more money, because that makes sense, right? Like you purchase luxury property, more people are going to pay a higher price per night. But the interesting thing is you made $130,000 on that property every single year. I literally just did underwriting this morning on a property in Breckenridge, walkable to Main Street. It was a $2 million property. And guess what I think that condo is going to make every year?
$130,000.
It's $130,000. And so there's like this crazy thing where you can literally have a $550,000 property today, let's call it 725, that is earning the same amount as a, you know, luxury condo in an area where you're like, of course people want to stay here. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, as far as I'll get into the revenue in a second, but from a cash flow perspective, the interest rates are hugely different today right now too. And so buying at 3.25%, I mean, that was an amazing, that probably makes this an extra $15,000 to $20,000 a year comparatively. But why do we think that is? I think it's somewhat of a bell curve, right? No matter how, I shouldn't say how little somebody makes, but there's kind of a standard in America that most people can afford. And then there's these heights where very few people can afford them. And especially in markets like Breckenridge and Vail and Summit County, there's a lot of homes that people can't afford to go to. So your market is just those luxury guests. Then they get to pick between the better homes and they get to kind of, you know, drive down that ADR a little bit. Now there's amazing deals in those markets too. And I'd like to invest there one day, but I didn't have the opportunity to prior. But I just think that it's kind of living in that middle zone of being at the high end of the middle class was really helpful for us.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you have known your avatar like since that first purchase. So let's talk about your next purchase, because like it was like quite a jump from purchase number one, but I feel like you implemented the same strategy and values that you had that worked really well for property one on a bigger scale in property two. So let's go through that deal.
Yeah. So there is some, I think, major changes in the second property. This is 2 years later now. We're in 2023, and the theme properties are everywhere. There's all over Arvada, all over Westminster, these areas that we're looking to buy. And the reason we're looking in those markets is the friendly regulation. And so we're still looking in some of those markets. I was also looking in the mountains at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided, I actually worked with a partner on that deal. He was doing a 1031 to pay for the property. And so we only had so many days to identify a property. We get to the end of that. I think it was 45 day period. And we're on day 44.
And you were, I was getting so anxious. I was like, good morning, Kyle. Today is day 44.
It was anxiety driving for me too. I mean, it's the first time I'm using somebody else's money to buy a property. I'm telling him everything's going to go extremely well. And I did believe that in my heart of hearts, but you have so much anxiety too. I mean, even using your own money, nonetheless, somebody else's. I think I underwrote the property we ended up buying 100 times. I had it down to, if we did $50,000 less a year than I thought, we'd still break even. But we were looking in the mountains. I mean, we really wanted a mountain property. And when it came to that 44th day, that we'd had this property on the back burner, but we knew it would be profitable. We also knew that where his money was sitting currently was a poor investment as far as continually kind of going forward with it. So we ended up, buying that property on the 45th day, or at least identifying it. And then to get into a little bit about that property, there's some differences now. So we knew that if we went with kind of a more typical theme, a more typical amenity setup, more typical home, we'd probably not be able to make the same cash flow I did in 2021 because of the different interest rates that are happening right now. And the prices now were 25% higher at least. And so we had to go kind of big. So this property had a probably 1700 square foot basement alone, and then some really nice vaulted ceilings and a pool and a hot tub room. And, we just felt like it was a blank canvas. And when I say a blank canvas, there were some definite things we had to cover up and fix as we went through that process.
Yeah, for sure. So the purchase price on this property was $900,000, as opposed to $525,000 mm-hmm. when you first purchased. And then I think something else that's interesting is the market had changed, you know, like supply had risen, especially in Arvada, which is a suburb adjacent to Denver. And so a lot of people have been nervous, you know, like, hey, there's a lot of inventory here. Am I going to be able to stand out? And I think that you being conservative in your underwriting really made sense. And we're also in this, at the time of this recording, like, I think that there's more volatility in this space than we've seen before. Like, there are some properties that are absolutely crushing it. And then there are some properties that are really struggling today. And so I think that it was wise of you to be conservative in underwriting that property. Walk me through the number of bedrooms and the square feet and what you all did from a design standpoint. Did you go as funky as you did the first time? Or what did you envision for this property to make sure that it was going to be a top performer?
Yeah. So this, at this point, 2 years later, I knew enough to know that I wasn't going to design it myself. Now, I still drove the project. I was a part of every single choice that was made, but the professionals in the space have gotten so good. And I think congruence of your design today is so much more important. People love to put in color and put in amenities now, but making it feel like there's a true theme, and a theme doesn't have to be superheroes and or skate parks or what have you. It has to be a feeling that you get, and maybe a color palette that's put in there to tie it all together. So when we looked at this property, I knew it would do well because there's no other property in the area that had 6 bedrooms. We ended up putting in 8 beds, all queens and kings, housing somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 people in beds, 20 people if they wanted to bring a couple extra. So we knew that was a great kind of set up. There was a big area in the middle that could house those same 20 people at a long table, as well as an outdoor table that can house 20 people. So we were trying to give them these areas that they could then, what I like to say is like, they could play cards as a group together at. When you're dragging these families out of the main city center, you want to give them a way to be able to feel comfortable hanging out together. So that, along with having the pool and the big game room, we felt like was a good baseline. And then we ended up bringing in Summer LED designs to kind of drive the actual color palette and the design. And something new that they had showed me on this property is that some of the finer details, the lighting in the property, the trim, some of the different outlets that we're using, the different types of lighting are so much more important than I had previously realized. And so we went with a mountain maximalist theme. We didn't want to push out any one type of group. We wanted it to be available for bachelorettes as well as bachelor parties, as well as families, and make it just, we did just go super, I guess, fun with it, but we wanted to stand out too. We used lots of actually dark colors within the property, which was nerve-wracking for me in the beginning and ended up working out super well. But yeah, I mean, hats off to them. And then we had a lot of great contractors too, and we kind of made little changes here and there and ended up working out better than I could have imagined.
Yeah, mountain maximalist is like the perfect way to describe what you guys did. It's like dark green and there's really cool wallpaper, and it kind of, it almost feels like you're at like a swanky bar, and not like a club way, but like a high end, like swanky stay. And so, yeah, I think it's great. Everything that we're talking about with your properties, I think that anybody that's listening to this right now is thinking, oh my goodness, he must get so many parties. There must be so much damage. Like, he's accommodating 18 to 20 people. I would never want to do that. How risky do you feel that these types of investments are when it comes to the type of groups that you're hosting? Like, are you experiencing issues with, you know, noise and damage and overall doom and gloom and destruction in these properties?
Mm-hmm. My biggest fear has always actually been somebody getting hurt, even, but I don't worry too much about parties. I mean, I do, but we put a lot of protection at the beginning. So we actually redid our corporate structure. We redid our LLCs, our holding company, got new insurance, and set everything up so we were completely buttoned up from like a liability standpoint as much as you can be on the corporate and insurance side. And then to take it one step past that, we have outdoor cameras, we have minute sensors, we have rules in our guidebook, anything that you can put in there to then deter partying. But frankly, there are going to be parties. And even if it's not a party, 20 people playing cards and having a few drinks, they're going to get a little bit loud. I guess what I would say is that while we do have parties, I think over the course of 3 years in the other property and now 6 months on the newer property, we've had maybe two or three issues that have amounted to $4,000 or $5,000. And those properties combined to over $100,000 a year in cash flow. So I'd far rather deal with those parties here and there than I would a property that isn't even, you know, paying for itself or paying me that extra cash flow. So it's kind of just a decision we made rather than that we're not afraid of partiers.
I think that that's really wise to think about, like, the cost benefit perspective of that. Like, yes, you are going to have some issues where someone breaks something, or you're going to have to like address like with them to, you know, be respectful or more quiet. But the majority of your guests are going to be good guests, like, especially with them being reviewed on the platform too. And for those couple of people that aren't good guests, you're getting paid well to solve that problem.
Absolutely. And from our management side, I mean, I find that our budget properties have as much parties as our higher end properties. These properties aren't cheap, right? I mean, in the summer, we're talking about $1,000 to $1,500 a night. And they say, you know, minimum 3-4 nights. They put a good bit of money up to stay there. And they, you know, they know that they could be charged additionally on the back end. So we haven't had too many issues there.
Yeah. Another thing that I think that you are extremely good at is getting great reviews on your stays. Talk to me about that. Like, how do you ensure that you have great reviews, and what do you do to mitigate a bad one?
Mm-hmm. So that starts, I mean, from the beginning on the process of ensuring your home's well stocked, ensuring your home's well maintained, ensuring that your, you know, sheets are clean, and not only clean, but finely pressed. Anything can cause a bad review these days. And then it's about having kind of a conversation and an open conversation with that guest. And so we day two, right at 11 a.m., I think it is, we ask them how their check-in went. We start to open that conversation up there. If there's an issue, that's normally when they're going to bring it to our attention. And then that gives us the entire rest of their stay to make it up to them, whether that's dropping off, you know, a bottle of wine, or it's giving them a call, and or it's having something fixed quickly. And then, you know, at the end of it, if they're still not happy, we are, you know, willing to talk to them about giving them some of their money back to save that review. We also let them know, you know, we talk to them about our business. We talk to them about how much it affects our business if they give us, you know, a lower review. We're not asking them to not give us lower review, but sometimes a guest thinks that, you know, 4-star means it was a great stay, and they don't know the difference between that, the 4th and the 5th star. And if we're not having that conversation with them, they won't know the difference. So keeping, you know, giving them that perspective is helpful as well. And I mean, that's kind of, once the review's been left, it's a lot harder than just doing the right things from the front end.
I agree. It's much easier to address it early on than have to deal with it after, because honestly, like, sometimes you'll have a guest that just doesn't have a good experience and you don't know about it. So if you're not checking in, and it does seem like, oh man, that must take so much time, but it is something that could be automated to check in with them and say like, hey, how are you doing? And I think that people underestimate the power of a phone call. I literally did this yesterday. So I had someone stay at my A-frame, which is like in the woods. And it was a single woman and her daughter. And they were so freaked out. Like, they were like, we think that someone is like following us. Like, it's just like, it's very quiet out there. They had like some like weird notification that there was like an AirTag, which was put by their rental car person. But she was so freaked out. And I was like, man, I am going to get a review that is like, this is the creepiest place to stay ever. It's a beautiful property, but it's like in the middle of the woods. And so I called her and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to say to her. Like, how do you calm someone down that's just like afraid for no reason? But I called her and she was like, I can't thank you enough for calling me. Just hearing that, like, you think that this neighborhood is safe and that you've spent time out here and knowing that you know your neighbors, you know the property. Like, it wasn't rational about that at that time. It was more emotional. And because I was able to have like an emotional connection with my guest, I think it made all the difference, made her more comfortable. And she left me a great review from it. And I think that you're really good at doing the same, is like really trying to connect on a human level. And that's hard to accomplish as like a larger property management company now. So talk to me about how you guys are still giving that like human touch.
You know, to your point, I think 95% of the time, 99% of the time, people just want to be heard. They want to be talked to. And when it's your property, your money, your decision-making power, that conversation is easier to have. It throws another wrench in when you're managing on behalf of somebody else. And then it throws another wrench in when you're having people do communications on your behalf, on behalf of somebody else as well. So that becomes, we have been building out policies, but we also have a couple escalation points. And I guess to make it, you know, to put it in real terms, how do we keep that sense of care? It comes back to really what we're telling our team when they ask us those questions. And it also comes back to kind of our morals. And so one thing I've noticed in our business is that as we grow, our systems change constantly, right? I mean, managing 10 homes is different than managing 20, which is different than managing 30, which is different than managing 100. And so our systems are always going to be changing, but our morals and our kind of our thought process around what matters can stay the same. So to us, what matters is always number one, first, guest experience. Our homeowners will understand if we did something in the spirit of giving our guest a good experience. And so that's kind of keeping that in the forefront, I think, is really important. And then our team knows, okay, if that's the lens we're looking through, then that helps them to really guide that conversation. And even if the policy says we don't give over a 30% refund for this type of issue, they can go to that person and say, well, let me just go back and talk to them, see what we can do here. And we try and really work with our guests in that level. So keeping your morals ahead of kind of your strict, hard rules, I think is how we do that.
I think that's really wise. On that note, I've never heard someone say that they have like a policy for like how much money they'll give in reimbursement for this or that type of issue. As far as refunds, like they are going to happen. It is a part of being a host. It is preserving your rating. And that's really important because guests, what would you say like a minimum standard of guest rating should be for a listing that you want to perform highly on the platform?
We try and be over 4.9 on all of our listings. 4.8 super host. We never really want to be getting close to that or dropping below that. So we try and be at 4.9 or higher on across the board. I think right now we're at 4.91 on our management site across the board, which is, it's tough, especially when it comes to refunds. You know, not every owner wants to give them. And so it's kind of a back and forth between the owners, the guests, ourselves. And that's why we had to start creating those policies actually, is more so that we could tell the owners we give refunds for things like this than it is to deter the guest from getting one.
I think that that makes a lot of sense. Something that I have done, and I don't know if you've tried this in your business, but I always ask the guest what they think is fair for the issue. And I am always surprised because I feel like at that point, someone, when you phrase it like that, what do you think is fair? It's setting the expectation that like we acknowledge that there's an issue here. I'm assuming that you're a reasonable person. You're assuming that I'm a reasonable person. What is fair? I hear you. I want to make this work. And I, every single time, with the exception for one instance, have always had guests come up with something that is like less than what I would actually be willing to pay or right in line with what I thought. Have you experienced that on your end? Do you think that the majority of guests are actually reasonable?
The far majority are. Yes. And we do exactly that, right? We ask them what they think is fair and they almost always come in with a pretty reasonable number. Another trick, I mean, when they don't come in with a reasonable number, when it's, we want a full refund because the freezer stopped running, we actually guide them to report us to Airbnb. And what I mean by that is that Airbnb has, and obviously it's different when it's Vrbo, Expedia, direct bookings there, but I think the majority of listeners probably aren't, you know, on a huge amount of sites. And if they are, they still get the majority of their bookings through Airbnb at this point, which there's things I'd like to say about getting off that site to an extent. But long story short, when somebody is coming at us with an unreasonable expectation, we tell them, we'd love for you to take these pictures and take what you found and bring it to Airbnb. They are in place as a mediator to tell us what we should be giving you back as a refund. And that really takes kind of the onus off of us on making that decision. They then generally give us a pretty good review. We tell them, you know, that we're going to do anything we can to fix it, but they're just in place as a mediator. And typically Airbnb gives even less if it's unreasonable. Now, if it's reasonable, they will give a full refund. And at that point, you know, we've kind of made our bed. But it's always a bit of a negotiation, a bit of a guessing game, a bit of, you know, trying to do what the right thing is too. So
I rely on Airbnb heavily for issues. So like if I ever have to collect payment from a guest for damage, I really love that they're in place to add a level of separation. And so for me, I try to keep it like as little emotional as possible and make it feel as corporate as possible. So I'll just go through their channel. I'll ask for, you know, the money that's needed to repair this or that. Or just like you said, if I have a super unreasonable guest, I will just call Airbnb customer support and I'll tell them the answer. And it is literally the coolest thing. They will get on the phone with the guest. They will be the mediator. So if you're someone who's like not great at like confrontation or like not great at like the customer relation aspect, I would rely heavily on them or on your property management team. Speaking about property management teams, I think that what you have built is so special. And I think that you are really boutique and that the values that you've had in your own portfolio have been translated to those that you manage. I think that you're really aggressive from a revenue standpoint. And my biggest complaint, my biggest complaint with a lot of property management companies is it feels that they exist to call the plumber, not necessarily to be a partner with you in generating the most return on the asset. And I think that that's something that sets you guys apart. Tell me what people should consider when they're interviewing a property manager. Like, what are some things that you guys offer that is maybe different than some of the big box companies that charge 10%, whereas you guys are probably between 20 and 30% depending on the asset?
Yeah. So we did to take one step back. We did start a second company this year as well for just revenue management, because to your point, many owners came to us and knew that they had great cleaners, they had great handymen, but they couldn't understand that side of the business, which active revenue management is a huge part of what we do. If you look at a company like Evolve, they rely fully on an algorithm, which is fine. But to say that, you know, 2 4-bedroom houses in the same neighborhood should be priced the same amount when one house is fully pink and Taylor Swift's coming to town, that's just not how, you know, that is in reality. So some of the things that we're trying to do differently, and also this isn't to take away from bigger companies, because as we've grown, there's actually a lot of things we've been able to get better at too, right? Some specialization can be extremely helpful, but from starting day one, I never really meant to start a management company in the beginning. I figured I just got into this industry. If I can help some people and learn from them at the same time, that was all I wanted to do, because I really didn't have a strong investing background. I knew that I would give all of our effort, but I didn't. And I knew a little bit about short-term rentals, and or a good bit at that point, I guess. But I wanted to learn from these investors who didn't understand short-term rentals. So I would go and help them with their short-term rental, their pricing, their strategy, their design. And in return, I would get to ask them, why'd you buy this property? What other investments do you have? And get to learn from them. And so we've tried to keep that mentality to this day, where it's we're consultants for our clients. And that's a huge difference, I think, that consulting aspect, because the property cannot, it has to start with the property you buy, then the design, then the management and the revenue management, and it all goes together. So if you're just taking this property and quote unquote optimizing it, well, that's not nearly as helpful if we talk to them about some of the different amenities they can add, some of the different design things that they can add. And then we optimize it from there and we go down the rabbit hole. I have gone down the rabbit hole for hours and hours and days on pricing, and none of, you know, the pricing is as important as having a great property to begin with. But then you can make a huge difference on your ROI through doing kind of those smaller things too. So the biggest difference, I think, between us and the bigger box stores is that consulting. And we're trying to do that with everyone in our company. We're trying to teach them what makes a good investment. We're also trying to help them invest in their own properties. And that's going to teach them, as you know, if they're, that's going to teach them more than anything, if they make a good investment or not. So that consulting aspect and understanding that it's humans talking with humans and working together to make their property successful will always be more important than kind of some of the bigger parts of the business from a system standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, a good property manager can really make such a difference, and it can really pay for itself. Like, I fully believe that you're bringing in more value than what it costs to use you at a property as a property manager. In a lot of instances, and I don't believe that for every management company that's out there. So like, how could people determine when they're interviewing a property manager how likely they are to do a good job?
Yeah, some things I've noticed on our end for that. I mean, I always say that our owners hire us for two reasons, which is to protect their homes and to make them more money. And so that breaks down into a couple different aspects. From a protect their home standpoint, you should be getting referrals from other people that they manage for. And more than one, they're going to have a couple buddies that they manage for across their portfolio. So getting those referrals is huge, and understanding, do they respond quickly? Do they, from a maintenance standpoint, or just do they respond quickly when you have concerns about your house? Most people you're managing for have 1, 2, maybe 3 homes, their biggest assets, and they want somebody who responds quickly to them about all their concerns and their worries. And it's an anxiety driving space for a lot of people. Not a lot of people are buying, you know, hundreds of homes, and it's all numbers on paper. But that really matters to them, everything in the property. So getting those referrals is huge. And then from a money standpoint, I would be asking them to see some of the revenues of some homes that are similar to yours in the area, as well as an owner statement. So one thing we've been pushing really hard this year is that historically we've been great. I was going to say incredible, but we'll stick with great for now. We've been great at driving revenue. We've been great at helping our owners to really amp up their home. We've been middle of the road, like everyone else, at our cost. So this year we're really focusing on how do we drive down our expenses. A lot of management companies will charge you to go out to the property for any reason. They will charge you, for these ticky-tacky little things. And we already don't do that, but now we're taking on, okay, how do we bring in some of these in-house maintenance people so that when we send them out for a small job, we don't have to charge them at all. So really, it's then when you look at that owner statement, it'll show everything from the different fees you're charging to what you're, not charging for effectively. So that is a big thing for us. I'd look at their owner statements. I'd talk to their different references. I'd ask them to see other properties that they manage for and the revenues on those properties and kind of compare it to yourself. You're investing in the property management company in a big way. I mean, we're not cheap and nor other management companies. So doing that due diligence up front, I think, is huge. And then ask them to go to your property. I can't tell you how many times I get right to the signing point and this person says, well, do you want to meet me at the property? It's like, of course we want to meet you there. We're going to be there all the time. If somebody doesn't go to your property, that's a huge red flag for me.
I think that that is a great qualifier because, to hire like some property manager, because a lot of people are like, oh, I'll do it anywhere in the state. And I think that there's ways to like grow and have systems for that. But if you have someone who's doesn't intimately know the property or have a team member that intimately knows the property, it's going to be really hard to answer, a guest that wants to know like how to work the garage door. Like it's those details make such a big difference in people's experience when they're actually staying. And so I like that. I also like, just to expand on some of the things that you said, like understanding who do they have as full-time staff as a resource to you? What other fees might be ongoing to expect outside of property management? What is included in their management? What is not included? And there are, there's a lot of different nuances, like, a maintenance tech to go out and like put in new batteries to the keypad is a different thing than like a plumbing issue, but really understanding like their fee structure, I think, is big. And then I think another thing that would be good to ask off the bat is what would you do to improve my property? Because then you're really digging into, is this person going to partner with me to maximize on revenue? Or is this person just going to alleviate the time that I'm spending, guest messaging and dealing with issues, which I think is half of the battle. But then the other half of the battle is really making sure that someone is maximizing on your investment.
Absolutely. And you don't have to do all those things. I mean, we don't help our owners buy homes per se. We don't help them design per se. We work with companies like yours. We work with designers in this area on actually doing those. But telling them that it needs to be done is super important. And yeah, I don't think that many people consult like that. And not just telling them, but putting them in touch with the right people, people that are trusted. I think that is such a big value that we bring and other boutique managers bring, is having that team that's not only the team you make, your money with and your business with, but the team of just people in your community that you can reach out to and introduce people to. That makes it as successful as anything.
Yeah. And I think both of us, we were talking before this podcast just about like the power of community in this space. Like, you don't know what you don't know. And I love that you said that you spent time with real estate investors and the value that you could add to their life was, hey, I can help you do this short-term rental side of it. Because as much as short-term rentals are real estate investing, it's two-part. It's like you're a real estate investor and there's like fundamentals of real estate investing that you have to understand. And then there's fundamentals of being a short-term rental host that you have to understand. And so I love that you sought out mentorship in a way where you were also providing value, as opposed to, I think a lot of people will be like, okay, I need to find like a real estate mentor. And it's always like a take relationship, but figuring out ways that you can really enhance the lives of people who can teach you something too, and having the humility to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually think that they're completely different businesses. I think we run a hospitality company, and I am personally an aspiring investor. I don't even think, wouldn't call myself that yet. But they are so different, and you know, you can make success in both sides, but yeah, they're completely different businesses. So we were able to, in the beginning, it was just helping people with their price labs and helping people with their design. And then, you know, one thing leads to another.
I love that. For anyone who wants to get in touch with you, Kyle, how can they find you? Where can they get in touch on social media as well as website, email, all that good stuff?
Yep. We have the best email is info@atomicstays.com. We have our website, atomicstays.com. And then those would be the best ways. We also have social media, but info@atomicstays.com. We'll get back to you within an hour or two.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on today, Kyle.
Thank you.
As always, thanks so much for listening. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend who's also interested in real estate investing. And don't forget to subscribe and give us a review wherever you listen or watch your podcasts.